always wanted to increase happiness. They have not always tried or wanted to calculate and measure happiness. I think this might be traced to the 19th century and the work of Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill, but it was certainly growing in intensity as an idea in the early 20th century, to the extent that questionnaires were being distributed to people, asking them to estimate their own happiness in an attempt to build up a picture of national happiness. This is a flyer that was distributed to the people of Bolton, asking them what happiness was for them, and through this attempting to kind of build up this picture of happiness. And I'm very interested in this move to measure happiness in ways that I'm still thinking about. I think a decision to measure happiness suggests fundamentally reassessing how happiness is understood. A decision to measure happiness almost suggests for the first time that it might be a kind of stuff, that it might be a type of commodity, it's something you can quantify. It also raises other questions. It raises questions about how you measure happiness, and questions about the individual and society. How much then does individual happiness count for in these collective measures of national happiness? Another question that became very important in the early 20th century was how much does individual happiness count for at moments of public distress? How much do those quite fleeting moments with flowers or beautiful June mornings count for in these collective measures? And to explore these ideas, I want to turn to my second literary example. And this is Virginia Woolf's novel, The Years, published in 1937. And as those of you who've read it will know, this novel is kind of Woolf's attempt to write a type of social history. She divides up her novel into particular years, and each chapter focuses in on a particular year and follows the lives of fictional characters throughout that year. I want to focus in on the 1914 chapter of The Years, because at the end of this chapter, Woolf turns again to explore the idea of happiness. So I'll first of all describe what happens at this point. At the end of the 1914 chapter of The Years, Woolf focuses in on the character Kitty. And Kitty, like Mrs. Dalloway, is a type of society hostess. And like Mrs. Dalloway, we see her throwing a party. But she then leaves the party, and we see her going to a station in London and getting on a sleeper train, which takes her to her home somewhere in the north of England. And throughout this whole narrative, Woolf shows Kitty becoming more and more happy. She's quite happy, firstly, to be leaving her party. And then, when she gets to the station and she walks along the platform, she's aware of the kind of high-vaulted roof of the station above her, and she's aware of the trains and their powerful engines on the tracks beside her, and she starts to feel this mounting sense of anticipation. And Woolf writes that the usual exhilaration mounted in her as she walked along the platform, diffused light poured down from a great height. And then she gets onto the sleeper train and she's delighted by her compartment, which I relate to. I love a sleeper train. I love those little compartments that are just yours for the night and you can fall asleep and wake up somewhere different. And Kitty feels likewise. She loves her sleeper train compartment, and who can blame her? And she looks around at the little lighted room. And then by the time the train starts, she's almost like a child with her excitement. We're off, she thinks to herself. And then the narrative follows her kind of falling asleep on the sleeper train, and that sense of relaxation as she just kind of gives herself over to being transported somewhere, knowing that in her busy day this is the moment where someone else is doing all the work, and that she need do nothing, she thought, nothing, but let herself be drawn on. The sound of the train became louder in the darkness, its roar, its vibration, seemed to fall into a regular rhythm of sound, raking through her mind, rolling out her thoughts. So the very rhythm of the train seems to kind of smooth out her anxieties. And with all these moments, Woolf creates a sense of mounting happiness, of exhilaration, anticipation, relaxation. But it's really when Kitty gets to her home and goes out for a walk and climbs to the top of the hill and kind of flings herself on the ground and looks over the countryside, that Wolf portrays what I think is the most absolute moment of happiness in all Wolf's writing. And I'm going to look at this in more detail. I'll read through this passage. This is Wolf describing Kitty walking to the top of a hill. The wind seemed to rise as she walked under the trees. Spring was sad always, she thought. It brought back memories. All passes, all changes, she thought, as she climbed up the little path between the trees. But she was in the prime of life. She was vigorous. She strode on. The ground rose sharply. Her muscles felt strong and flexible as she pressed her thick-soled shoes to the ground. The trees thinned as she strode higher and higher. Suddenly she saw the sky between two striped tree trunks extraordinarily blue. She came out on the top. The wind ceased. The country spread wide all round her. Her body seemed to shrink, her eyes to widen. She threw herself on the ground and looked over the billowing lands that went rising and falling, away and away, until somewhere far off it reached the sea. Dark wedges of shadow, bright breadths of light lay side by side. Then, as she watched, light moved and dark moved. Light and shadow went travelling over the hills and over the valleys. A deep murmur sang in her ears, the land itself singing to itself, a chorus, alone. She lay there listening. She was happy, completely. Time had ceased. I love this theme, and I love it because it's so absolute about Kitty's happiness here. Kitty was happy completely. The theme's also crucial to my ongoing research because it asks complex questions about happiness. Because this passage, as I said, is at the end of the 1914 section of The Years, and this sentence, time had ceased, is the last sentence of that chapter. The next chapter skips ahead to 1917 and it opens on an air raid. And so this moment of happiness is written into Wolf's text on the very edge of war. And this raises questions. Why would Wolf write happiness into her novel at this moment when it's about to be radically dismantled? And this, after all, is quite a strange scene. This phrase, time had ceased, on the one hand, it seems to suggest just kind of giving yourself over to the present moment, not worrying about the past, not worrying about the future. On the other hand, it can be read as quite eerie, as apocalyptic, time had ceased. I think this moment of happiness can't be easily dismissed, though, even though it's in a strange position. For one thing, there's just so much energy that goes into this scene. We focus in on Kitty's energy, flexing her muscles, walking to the top of this hill. And Kitty and Wolf as well puts a lot of energy into this writing of this scene. She traces Kitty's happiness from the moment she leaves London. And she carves out a moment in her narrative, the scene of happiness, at a time when it might not seem to have a natural place. Another thing I'm interested in with this entire narrative is a particular image that keeps coming up. As a literary critic, I'm often interested in when writers use particular images and when these images get repeated. I'm interested in thinking about the thought processes behind that. And the image that comes up repeatedly in this whole long narrative is the image of the small room, the small space, the small compartment. I mentioned the sleeper train compartment. Later, when Kitty has breakfast, she has breakfast in a room where the light is coming in through the window and it's coming from the garden. It's almost like green light. And she describes being in the porch of her house as being like being held in the hollow of an emerald. So this, again, this image of being held, being contained. I'm interested in this because I think there's a type of happiness which might be rather like being in a sleeper train compartment, which might be quite contained, which might be not something that's going to last, but kind of holds you in the moment whilst it does last. And I think that's partly because it's an image Virginia Woolf liked. In her diary, she said something peculiar. She said that the perfect day is like a perfect piece of cabinet making, beautifully fitted with beautiful compartments. And what I think she meant by this image of these kind of beautiful compartments in the perfect day, and what I think she means by Kitty's happiness, is that it's possible, even within the darkest of times, to carve out these moments for happiness, to build happiness and compartmentalize it, if even for one moment. And this suggests a type of logic that goes against the logic of measuring mass national happiness. It suggests how happiness might be tiny, it might just be for one person, but still it's important and still it counts. And this is a complex idea that Virginia Woolf continued to think about. In one of her diaries following the years, she described having breakfast and going out into her garden and looking around and thinking about all the beauty. And she writes, it's almost too much beauty. She writes, so much beauty, too much for one pair of eyes, enough to float a whole population in happiness. And I'm interested in this phrase because enough to float a whole population in happiness shows Woolf very clearly thinking about these measures of national happiness, thinking about happiness and populations. But she subverts the logic of such measurements. She suggests there's almost enough here for a whole population, that one person's happiness is almost enough. And then, in her diaries in the Second World War, this idea gets even more complex, because her Second World War diaries are absolutely filled with considerations of how much one person's personal private happiness really counts at this moment when so many people are suffering. And to give an example, this is a short quotation from Woolf's diary. And here she's describing a beautiful day, and it's so beautiful, it seems like it could be June, even though it's January. And Woolf records, the beauty was ethereal, unreal, empty, a June day, 10 degrees of frost, all silent, as if offered from another world, the specimen against the war. So at first, this beautiful day and any happiness it might contain seems just unreal, empty. But it also seems like a type of gift, as if offered from another world. And then when Woolf writes, this specimen against the war, she seems to be almost suggesting it's some kind of act of defiance, that she's setting this moment against the war, this one beautiful day against the war. And this is something she repeatedly does. She repeatedly keeps trying to add up kind of private personal happinesses and measure them against what she calls all this war misery. And so Virginia Woolf's work at once gives us, I think, quite an interesting fine-grained description of what it is to be happy. It also explores questions about the measuring of happiness. But in addition, it suggests that it can be an important act of defiance just to record happiness. I've come to think that this is one of the things Woolf's work does, and some of the other writers of the early 20th century do something similar. They're interested in finding a form of happiness that is durable, that lasts. Indeed, I think some of these writers almost try to write happiness into being, to craft it by the force of their writing. This isn't, incidentally, the usual view of literature and happiness. There's a prevailing view that happiness is somehow a difficult subject for literature. There's a saying that happiness writes white, that you can't see it, that happiness somehow doesn't have enough drama or enough tension or enough interest to make it a good artistic subject. The novels may well have happy endings, but a whole novel about happiness would just be artistically not feasible. I don't know whether this is true, and I certainly don't think it's true for the writing of the early 20th century. And so to explore this a little further, I want to turn to my final literary example. And this is the poetry of T.S. Eliot. So T.S. Eliot has also rarely been seen as a writer of happiness. He's known for having had a very unhappy first marriage. He's known for a major nervous breakdown. He's known, too, for religious views which made him suspicious about the value of mere worldly happiness. But I think, too, he was interested in happiness. During the First World War, he wrote to his cousin, Eleanor Hinckley, and he praised her for describing moments of happiness in her letters. He wrote to her, "You always begin by conjuring up the exact image of a Sunday afternoon and evening with baked beans and toast and cocoa and other nice things and firelight, quite as it always was. Perhaps you hardly realised yet what the effort to keep oneself unaffected by the war means, but I think it was instinctive force of character. So here again, oddly, it seems to be an act of defiance, almost integrity, to set down the good things in life, the happy things, which here, surprisingly enough for T.S. Eliot, are baked beans and toast and cocoa. But who can argue with this? So I think Eliot was interested in happiness, but perhaps a more kind of fraught and interesting and complex exploration of happiness and a revaluing of happiness can be seen in his famous sequence of poems, the Four Quartets. And these were published between 1935 and 1942. I want to focus in on the second one, East Cocoa, which was published in 1940. And at first glance, this poem, East Cocoa, just seems to offer ammunition for people who want to see Eliot as an innately depressed and depressing poet. It describes what it's like to find oneself in the middle of a life that just seems to have gone somehow wrong. And it describes moments of happiness, but they're always lost, or they're unreal. They're just imagined, hypothetical moments of happiness. But then it does something else, and I'm interested in the way it kind of gathers its poetic strength and manages to write something like happiness, even under conditions which seem unpropitious. And this is the ending of the second of the quartets, and it's a complex passage. Eliot, having suggested that moments of happiness are lost amidst endless unhappiness, then reflects, and he writes, "There is a time for the evening under starlight, a time for the evening under lamplight, the evening with the photograph album. Love is most nearly itself when here and now cease to matter. Old men ought to be explorers. Here and there does not matter. We must be still and still moving into another intensity for a further union, a deeper communion. Through the dark cold and the empty desolation, the wave cry, the wind cry, the vast waters of the petrel and the porpoise. In my end is my beginning." So Eliot begins this here, just a list of evenings. And we don't know what it is about these evenings. We don't know what happened in the evening under starlight, the evening under lamplight. But he isolates them for our attention. They seem to be important. And actually now, having read his letter to Eleanor Hinckley where he mentions the firelight, I tend to kind of think of the two things alongside each other. I think these are kind of evenings that matter, moments which seem to stand out from the rest of life and seem to want to be remembered. He's no sooner mentioned the evening under lamplight than he feels compelled to add in an extra detail, the evening with the photograph album. And at first, Eliot seems to be holding fast to these evenings, like Virginia Woolf held onto moments of contentment during the war. But this poetry also does something else. It also lets go of these moments. It says, here and now cease to matter, here and there just does not matter. This is the opposite of Mrs. Dalloway kind of clinging to the present moment in Woolf's novel. The poetry at this stage offers us an image of endless darkness, through the dark cold and the empty desolation. But the way Eliot writes it, it seems for a moment exhilarating. The wave cry, the wind cry, the vast waters. Eliot suggests what is important here is adventure. Old men ought to be explorers. And so I think Eliot's doing different things with his poetry here. He's at once treasuring and cherishing moments of happiness and using his poetry to kind of hang on to them. But he's also radically revaluing and reconfiguring happiness, and he's transfiguring darkness to exhilaration. This is what I think much of the writing of the early 20th century tries to do, and I think it's why writers like Virginia Woolf and like T.S. Eliot are so interesting in thinking about happiness. They show us how literature can offer us a complex description of what it is to be happy and how it can begin to intervene in questions and debates that are still being had today. But also what I think these writers do by writing about happiness is to find ways to be happy, even at the darkest moments, to to write happiness into being. And so, to conclude, whilst the early 20th century may well have been seen as a time of sadness, it was a time of collapsed hopes, it was a time of ruins, it was also a time of making happiness out of the fragments. I think when Virginia Woolf wrote, "We must make happiness," her words echo throughout literature that's so often concerned with shoring fragments against ruins, with tracing the sources of our contentment, and using their literature to craft ever more resilient versions of happiness. Thank you. Thank you for listening.